Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by two of our wonderful contributors, Ashanti Omkar, hello.
Hello.
And Layla Lateef.
Hi.
It's an all-girl one. It's the first one we've done.
Hot girl summer, literally.
It's a hot girl summer, and we mean that in a temperature fashion. But also, they are extremely hot. I'm looking at them, they are. So this week, we're talking to director Kate Herron about Loki and taking a look at M. Night Shyamalan's latest rug puller, Old, Kate Beckinsale's actioner Jolt, Kevin Smith's Masters of the Universe and Riders of Justice, starring Mads Mikkelsen and festival darling The World to Come. But before we start on those, what have you guys been watching this week, aside from all of those delights?
I was one of the lucky people that got to go and see the first 10 minutes of Dune, which I thought I had to keep a secret, but then everybody else tweeted about it, so I think it's fine. I am so excited for this film, having gotten that tiny little snippet. It looks incredibly exciting. And then it just got announced yesterday that a director I absolutely love, Bassem Tarek, who did Mogul Mowgli last year, is going to be directing the new Blade. So I popped on over to Netflix and I watched, she's got a really great short documentary, Ghosts of Sugarland, all about a kind of young man in a friend group who ends up kind of being radicalized. And it's very short, it's quite unusual, and it's really moving. So very excited to see what him and kind of world's greatest actor Mahershala Ali come up with.
Right, amazing. What about you, Ashanti? What have you been clapping your eyes on?
I feel like I've not been out at all because I've just been binging on things. So the Ted Lasso season two came out, and well, it's just come out, and we were lucky enough to see 8 episodes, and wow, they've kept the tone of this so beautiful. It just feels so good to see something that's so heartwarming, and I can highly recommend it. Then there's Never Have I Ever season two. Again, these season twos are coming and really making us smile because there was so much anticipation after watching season one of both Ted Lasso and Never Have I Ever, and they have delivered on both counts. I saw Night of the Kings, which I really, really, really liked. That idea of the African storytelling with the music and the dancing and how they wove that into the story was just really incredible. And Limbo is hitting the big screens. And when I saw it last year, I was super hyped. And I got to chat with Ben Sharrock as well and Amir El-Masri about it. And I just loved what they had to say and their energy. You're going in with my energy because as an immigrant myself, this film hit all the notes really, really correctly.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one, I have to say, but I've heard so many good things about it. I'm desperate to see it. So I shall be popping down to my cinema to take a look at that. So that is out next week, which we will be talking about on next week's pod. But for now, we should get to this week. So let's just talk Loki now, because Marvel's latest TV show has changed everything about the forthcoming MCU. So Matt Matum sat down with Kate Herron to talk about He Who Remains, Variants and Alligator Loki. A warning, there's spoilers here, so skip ahead if you're still not caught up on this show. And to kick things off, Matt asked Kate what the most exciting thing was that she got to introduce to the MCU with the Loki show.
I think the first and foremost excitement for me, right, was getting to like dig back into Loki's story, because I think he's one of the most exciting characters in the MCU, and I think he's had this just amazing arc over the last 10 years. So the fact that I was getting handed that character was like massive for me, because one, I was like, okay, don't mess this up, you know, because he's so beloved. But at the same time, I was just so happy to have the opportunity, because I thought the arc that was there for him in this story was really exciting, and it was definitely taking him to a new place. And then beyond that, obviously the massive repercussions from episode 6, you know, with He Who Remains and the multiverse, and again, was like another massive thing to be handed the keys to. So I was like, oh wow, this is going to be quite big.
So how do they kind of deal with giving you things like that to introduce? Do you get a strict rule book of things you need to follow, or are you given quite a lot of freedom?
So basically Marvel, they always have an executive on every film. So we had Kevin Wright, and basically kind of like there's a Kevin Wright on every production who essentially is like your producer, but they're also kind of like the Marvel gatekeeper, I guess, or overseer, but they kind of just let you know, although they have internal meetings to check nothing's going to ripple too much on other projects. But I think really honestly the genius of Kevin Feige and his team and Kevin Wright was that I never felt restricted. When I joined the project, I knew that we were introducing He Who Remains, so that was already kind of set in place. I think mainly it was just me and the writers being like we're actually, okay, cool. We actually get to do this. Okay, great. It's almost like reminds me of that, you know, being fired from a job and just keep showing up. and we were just like, okay, let's just pretend that he's definitely going to be in it until they say he can't be. But yeah, but he is. And I think that was massive for us. But no, I think there's not so much a restriction. If you want to pitch an idea or a character or something, if it could have a ripple effect that would affect another project, they'll let you know. But generally, no, I think Kevin Feige was always like, go bigger, go weirder. The awesome thing is they always want what's best for story, and that wins, and then they kind of work it out with the rest.
And kind of talking of He Who Remains, played by Jonathan Majors, of course, like, how does casting an actor like that work in the MCU, where they're obviously going to play such a huge part going forward? Was he cast before you were working on the show, or were you involved in the casting?
So Peyton and I and Kevin Feige and the executives at Marvel, I was part of that conversation with them, which was a massive honor, because I was like, this is such a big decision for them. We had a conversation about like kind of what I was looking for with He Who Remains, and what we felt could work best for that role. And then Peyton was obviously talking about what he was looking for with his role. But I think for us, like, united was that we were all just so excited by Jonathan Majors. Like, he's an amazing actor. And no, I was part of that conversation in that sense. And I can't speak for other projects, obviously, if there's any crossover roles for people, but that's how we handled it on our show.
For He Who Remains, what kind of influences did you talk about with Jonathan? Was there any kind of reference points you both had for, like, when you were thinking about making this version of the character?
I think we both definitely spoke about The Wizard of Oz, because Jonathan also does the voice of the Timekeepers in episode 4, because basically when we cast him, I hadn't found someone to do the voices of that character, and Wizard of Oz is obviously a clear reference for us as a team. Mm. And I was like, oh, well, it has to be the wizard, let's get Jonathan, because he's an amazing character actor. And I remember sending him like the art of the Timekeepers, and he was sending me and Kevin Wright back all these incredible voices, so that definitely fed in as a reference. And I think Jonathan as well for Willy Wonka, I think, was a big one for him. His work as a clown, like, he studied clowning. So I know that he definitely brought that to the role. I think honestly with Jonathan, we spoke a lot about more the themes, to be honest, like free will. And also we spoke about like introvert, in the sense that it's introverted because he's living on his own. Probably the only person he really talks to is a cartoon clock. But then there's the extrovert, in the sense that, you know, he's a great storyteller. And I know the writers as well drew a lot from like entrepreneurs and like that kind of showmanship. I think kind of that all melded together. But with Jonathan, honestly, he's just such an amazing actor. I think it was really for us just talking about the emotional high and low points when we want the audience to believe him, because like Loki and Sylvie, there needs to be so much that you could be on Sylvie's side and be like, I think this guy's a liar. But then he needs to be convincing as well, because I think for me, like when he says, just wait until you meet my variants, for me, I feel like he's telling the truth there. And that makes me excited as a fan for what's to come. But also it makes me like, no, don't do that. What are you doing, Sylvie? So I think that was really fun. And working with, you know, Jonathan like that was really helpful, I think, in that sense. But honestly, he's so good. You just kind of, you got to just let him go and would touch base and be like, okay, well, let's push it this way. I'll push it this way.
And obviously a huge part of the excitement of the show has been the variants, especially the Loki variants. Like, were there any that you kind of liked the idea of, but that just didn't make the cut for whatever reason?
I feel like so happy because we got Kid Loki in there, which was a big one for me. And then I think when we were talking about, you know, classic Loki, I think that was exciting because the costume, I think, was up in the air for a while. And then I was like, oh, I think it'd be cool if he's in like the old, you know, older style costume, because I like the idea of him looking like he was from a movie made about Loki, like maybe 40 years ago, or which I thought was kind of fun. But no, I really love all our Lokis. I think Diobia's Loki is really fun because it's a completely, you know, unique creation. Alligator is wild. I was so, that's from the writers, and I thought that was so funny. And we've got President in there. I mean, the one thing is there's always so many more Lokis, I'm sure, to like bring in there, but I feel like we've got a really good selection of them all. No, I'm very happy with the ones we have in.
And just to wrap up quickly on the kind of ridiculously popular alligator Loki, what's kind of his backstory in your mind? Is it kind of a Loki transformed into an alligator, or does he come from a world where everyone's an alligator? What's your take on it?
My assistant actually had an amazing theory. He thought that he was Thor and that Richard's character had transformed him into an alligator and was pretending that he was a Loki, which I thought was really twisted and quite funny. I guess my interpretation is, oh, I'm not sure. I guess like I love the idea of a world of alligators, though. That's really fun. But part of me finds it funnier if almost he just turned into one and something went wrong. I think it's something that we all found hysterically funny. But I think the real challenge for me, I guess, in terms of directing it and working with a visual effects team, was that there had to be a line of kind of like when they're discussing if he's a Loki or not in the barbershop, like I think it needs to kind of like He Who Remains, I guess, in the sense of, is he lying or is he not? Like with Alligator, it had to be like, okay, there has to be a believable level that this could just be an alligator they put horns on. But at the same time, some of his actions, like when he bites off the hand of President, and like, I think then you're like, well, I think he is a Loki. So yeah, it's, which I think is quite beautiful. So yeah, so I think for me, that was always the fun, was kind of giving people enough to debate it either way.
Okay, so from one god of mischief to another, M. Night is back with more twists and turns with this.
What's happening to us?
My daughter just turned 6 2 weeks ago.
Mom?
Whatever's happening to us is happening very fast.
You have wrinkles.
There's something wrong with this beach.
What's happening?
Mom! Mom! I'm scared!
So this is old. Ashanti, do you want to tell us what this is about? What is the twist here? Well, obviously you can't tell us the twist, but what's the premise here?
The premise is that there are several families that have gone on holiday to this gorgeous beach resort. They're told that there's this very special island that just has glistening rocks, etc., etc. Do you want to go and see it? M. Night himself drives them there. And
of course he does.
That's because he makes cameos in, yes, all his films, of course, and he's looking really good, actually. And he drives them there. And of course, we as viewers are thinking,
I know, who would allow him to drive you anywhere and take you to anywhere, knowing what you know of his films, right? But they
exactly.
do.
Exactly, but they do. And of course, these people get there and weird things start to happen. You know, it starts off with a body floating into this island and then odd things where people seem to be aging quicker than they should be. And I don't want to give away any spoilers, but it really does give you the heebie-jeebies. They use sound design in a very clever way to also make you feel like you're going to jump out of your seat. And it just kind of is this story about why this is happening to these people. Are they going to survive? Are we watching Lost again? I mean, mm-hmm. these are all the things you'll be thinking while watching this. And there might even be a little mention of Lost in it. It's one of those films where I felt personally that he has made a bit of a comeback with this after having a few misses. Mm-hmm. This one feels like a bit of a hit to me.
What about you, Layla? Is this The Happening or is this Sixth Sense for you?
Oh, this is top tier. This
really?
Is top tier. Yeah, wow. I think this is going to be a Marmite film. I am firmly in the camp of I loved it.
What did it have going for you then?
Well, I think I've kind of spent way more time thinking about old than most people because I did a profile of Gael Garcia Bernal for the new issue of Total Film. And so I read the book and I spoke to him about it. And then I ended up getting nervous because I was like, ooh, why aren't they screening this yet? Is it because they know that it's like really rubbish? And I came in quite nervous, but I was like, no, surely with a cast this great, it's got to be good. And I really think that with all that background, it's made me appreciate it more, having read the graphic novel, seeing exactly what he's done with the adaptation, see where he kind of added in ideas, kind of wrapped things up in different ways, kind of took certain elements out of it and put stuff in. Like, I just thought it was the most fun I've had with one of his films. And I really, really enjoyed it. It's kind of unhinged in all of the best ways. I think it was really, really gross at times and really, really funny at others. And I love this idea of like, oh, it's not just about like, people are going to get old, but like, what does that mean for scars? What does that mean for like, if you have kind of eyesight, how's that going to affect it? And I really, really enjoyed it. And I know a lot of people won't, but like, love.
Same for you, Shanti. Say love or a little less?
Same for me, love. I would say love because there was so much to think about. And what Layla said is exactly right. It started making me think. And on the journey back home, that's all I could think about. And it's very rare that a film does that for me, to think outside what the film's premise is, which I really thought was great. And there was also this one line, I'm sure Layla heard me laughing out loud at that point, when the guy, there's a rapper character called Mid-Sized Sedan in this, and the young girl in it is, you know, she goes crazy at the fact that he is on this kind of mysterious island with them. And there was one point when he said, this is the first time they wish they were black, because I always say this about black don't crack, because black people tend to age slower than everyone else. And that just made me, I mean, I was the only one there who probably laughed out so loudly.
Oh no, I was in the back row. I had a lot of laughing moments. I really didn't expect it to be so funny. It's really funny.
It is.
And particularly Aaron Pierre is so funny in it. And especially Rufus Sewell plays this kind of like slightly monstrous Uber Karen man. Just, it's a lot weirder and wackier than I expected, because actually this tone of the graphic novel is quite like dreamy and sad, but that's like not at all what this is. I love the Twilight Zone. It reminded me of that. Totally here for old.
Is it one of those things, I obviously didn't see it because I was in a screening for another Hush Hush film this morning and so couldn't make it, but is it like The Sixth Sense in as much as once you know the twist, it's kind of spoiled? Or, I mean, should people go in knowing absolutely nothing about this, really?
I wouldn't say there really is much of a twist. What I would say is it's more got a little bit of Signs in that the weakest thing is the last 10 minutes. I mean, with Signs, I actually was kind of punching the air. I hated the last 10 minutes so much. This wasn't quite as bad. I don't think he fully knew how to kind of wrap up the madness, but, you know, I'll forgive him for that.
Okay. Has it put you off going onto a lovely beach?
You know what? I have to admit, while I was looking at those gorgeous vistas that they showed, I had this sudden worry thinking, will I ever go to one of those hidden beaches again? I am not sure. But also, I wanted to say that the premiere for this in America, where the Night Shyamalan family were all there, they all looked utterly gorgeous. And his daughter, Shana Knight, who is an up-and-coming director, he's literally training her. And she has actually worked on this film. And his daughter, Salika, whom I've spoken to a few times, she's an amazing musician. And her song actually comes at the end credits. And it's really beautiful. So I'm giving a shout out to that as well.
There's a whole fam going on. It's the entire fam having a thing on this. Okay, so I think we're highly recommending this for people to go to the cinema and give themselves a little bit of a summery treat.
Yeah, I think about 40% will hate it, but yeah.
But that's always quite good, isn't it? It's quite good to go and see a film that's going to so divide people. There's nothing worse than coming out and everyone going, that was all right.
I think this could have quite easily gone into bad if it didn't have the amazing cast that it has. I mean, even like someone like Alex Wolff or Thomasina McKenzie, like they kind of have these quite difficult things to do of being adults that were kids, you know, 6 hours ago. Doing a bit of childishness as an adult, you have to be skilled, I think, to pull that off and not have it just be totally cringe.
Certainly sounds incredibly intriguing. So shall we look and see what else we can watch? From the shocking discoveries in old to shock tactics in this.
I've got this condition. It makes me snap.
Like Tourette's?
Just a tiny bit more intense.
I've upped the voltage, but there's only so much that the human body can take.
So this is Jolt, which is Kate Beckinsale kicking ass, isn't it, Layla? Tell us what she's up to.
Yes, this is Kate Beckinsale as Lindy, who is a woman who has a problem that she sort of, if she gets angry or annoyed, it just fills her with like murderous intentions. And in order to deal with that, she has this sort of technology fitted to her where she can give herself a shock of electricity to kind of stop herself from, you know, killing 1,000 people a day. So on the advice of her shrink, Dr. Munchen, who is played by Stanley Tucci, she decides to go on a date with a very charming Jai Courtney, which goes far, far better than she thinks it will. And I think they have 3 dates and then he gets murdered and she decides that she is going to go off on a quest to kind of avenge him.
Yes. How did we like this, ladies? Ashanti, you're giggling.
You know, this is like the rise of the action MILF film. You know, Kate is looking fantastic in it. There's this kind of weird thing where they go into the house and the number of the house almost looks like a 69 when it falls. And she says, oh, I love this guy because he, you know, said he was going to cook fish for me. You know, there were things to like about it. I love the fact that it was made by a woman, but it just felt like if I paid money to go and see it, I would regret it. I'm fine to watch it on a streamer. I'm okay. I mean, yes, I'm paying money for that, but it's okay to watch it on the small screen. But it wasn't very consistent. Everything from accents in various places. You're seeing South Bank, you know, at one stage.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's like I struggled to understand at the beginning where this was set. Yep. And I thought, yes, everyone's doing American accents, or some people are doing what they think are American accents. But that's clearly London. What's going on? Exactly. It was very, very confusing. But I think that probably is sort of showing that it's a little cheap.
Yeah. For the first 10 minutes, I was like, am I into this? Like, I think this might be like kind of a guilty pleasure. And then by about minute 11, something kind of switched. I'm like, no, this is just boring. I think the jokes stopped working for me. In the first kind of 10 minutes, it was all a bit kind of like madcap. But then it's just a lot of the same after that. A lot of her shocking someone, her shocking herself, and then trying to, you know, fantasizing about killing people and stuff. And I just kind of got a bit bored with it. There were a couple of set pieces that I did think were like really fun and how crazy they were. There's one in a hospital nursery that I did quite enjoy.
It was, yes.
Yeah, and I liked Laverne Cox in it very much. But I think the twists at the end you saw coming a mile away.
Totally agree with you on that. I mean, I think it sort of doesn't work, but then I felt like it kind of rose above its cheapness and its obviousness, and the fact that it sort of reminded me of, what was that Scarlett Johansson film where she had a drug leak in her and she suddenly became, it sort of reminded me,
Lucy.
It reminded me of so many other films that I've seen before. But the thing that sort of worked for me and the thing that kept me interested was actually Beckinsale and Tucci and Laverne Cox. Yeah. For reasons known only to those people, they had decided to come on this project and give it their sort of little extra flair. I mean, that doctor role could have been played by anybody, but in Tucci's hands, the Tooch, he's just making it great, isn't he? He's in a couple of scenes looking lovely in his sort of shabby chic room and with his tailored outfits, and you know, just delivering this terrible script in a way that totally works. I felt like it sort of worked despite itself. I also liked the fact that it had the words twat and bumhole and bollocks in it, which we just don't hear enough in big action films, do we?
It's true.
And there was a lot of kicking in the balls, which, you know, it was just like, she just did a lot of kicking the balls. Admired that she could do so much in heels. But I think that's probably, again, Kate Beckinsale's skill, from what I know of her on social. She can do anything in heels, that woman, can't she? It sort of tried to be a feminist war cry, but sort of didn't.
I kind of smirked a little when Molly Moore's Handsomer song came up. You know, I don't need a man. No, I need a manicure. Just like, okay.
Yeah. Very on the nose. Yeah.
It did make me think that we're not using Kate Beckinsale as well as we should, that she is a lot funnier and a lot better at action than kind of the roles that she's been given. But I didn't think this solved that.
No, because it's sort of treading ground we've seen her in the Underworld series, so it's nothing really new. I think her skills with a script were there, that she can actually act and she can actually, you know, take something mediocre and make it a little bit cool and quirky and fun.
And she looked fabulous. She looked fabulous the whole time.
And not a cheap wig. That was a decent wig.
That was a good wig.
You know how I feel about a wig, ladies, and that one was pretty good. I was like, thank you for spending the budget on the wig. But why is everyone doing things in the Tate Modern? Confusing.
My new theory is it's because I'm pretty sure Stanley Tucci lives in London, I reckon.
He does.
To do this, they were like, listen, we will come to you, Mr. Tucci.
Whatever works for you, Tucci. You know,
films in London now, done.
Yeah. You'll be able to make cocktails around this at home. Won't disturb your pasta eating. Will you please do it? Yeah. Apparently it was filmed in London and Bulgaria.
So and Bulgaria. And I have a feeling they used maybe Pinewood, but the set that they built for it just looked really odd. It looked like a set, and I didn't like that. We're so used to seeing television series with real life locations. So when they use a set, they've got to do it really well, or it has to have some kind of different dimension feel to it. And this just didn't have that.
It did set itself up as a franchise opener. Do you think we'll see more?
No.
No.
No, well, because I've seen so little about this, aside from, I think the first I heard of it was when you told me about it for this podcast. So I think they're sort of dumping it. I don't know exactly how these things work with Amazon, but it does seem like they're not putting a lot of budget behind getting the word out for it, which to me suggests no more.
And especially with that final scene, and you see that big, big actress whom we all love so much turning up in it, and you feel like, oh, why didn't you give this so much more so that it could have become a franchise? There was a lot of potential. I feel it was just misplaced a bit.
Yeah, I agree. But it's available on Amazon from today. If you're drinking a beer and you fancy just something a bit mindless and silly, would you suggest it to people?
Yeah, I think maybe that was my mistake. I didn't give myself a beer.
We're not
a gin and tonic drinking.
For me. We are suggesting that it might help things. Just oil the wheels on that. Okay, so that is Jolt, and that is available on Amazon Prime. Right, it's time for alternative line reading. Are you ready? This is where I read a line, and you have to guess what film it's from, but I'm not going to do it in the style of the original line reading. I'm going to do this like a baby. Now, if nobody loses their head, nobody will lose their head. What film is that from?
See, I'm normally so rubbish at this, but because this scene is so part of my sexual blossoming, as it like, it is, of course, Brad Pitt in Thelma and Louise, as he kind of stands at the bottom of the bed with a hairdryer and a pair of jeans and no shirt, looking the best that a human being has ever looked. Yes, like you could have done it in Bulgarian and I would have gotten that.
So that, yes, I did it in honour of the fact that we are an all-girl group today and we are riding into the sunset.
Ladies, gentlemen, let's see who wins the prize for keeping their cool. Simon says, everybody down on the floor. Now, nobody loses their head, then nobody loses their head. You, sir. Yeah, you do the honors. Take that cash, you put it in that bag right there. You got an amazing story to tell your friends. If not, well, you got a tag on your toe. You decide.
Okay, shall we move on then to something completely different? By the power of Grayskull, it's this. Ashanti, this is Masters of the Universe, retooled, it's back. There's He-Man, Skeletor, they're all back. Why? What has Kevin Smith done to them?
Well, you know, the first thing I thought when they announced it was, why exactly? Because, you know, no one asked for this to come back. But, you know, I was a fan of this as a child in Nigeria because we didn't have many options. This was one of the series that they decided to beam to us every week. So I watched it. And this one is really interesting. It's interesting that Netflix has taken this on because, you know, it's a Mattel toy, you know, and it had such a old school feel to it even back then. And now they've made it seem exactly like that because they've labeled it as a love letter to the original, which it certainly is. I think that they haven't evolved it too much except to throw in like a black character and that kind of thing. It's kind of a product of its era. And, you know, 4 decades ago, I think it really worked, you know, that realm of Eternia. We hadn't seen, you know, obviously we hadn't seen Pixar films and Marvel films. So it kind of took me a while just to adjust to the style of animation I was seeing. Because again, we haven't seen that style in a long time. Of course, it has Mark Hamill as Skeletor. So I had to watch it. Mm-hmm. And after episode 2, weirdly, I kind of got hooked. And by episode 4, I couldn't stop watching it. And then, of course, it ended on episode 5 because it's in 2 parts and they've given us only part 1 right now. And I was excited. I mean, Sarah Michelle Gellar, she was Buffy. I loved her. And she plays Teela in this. And this time round, Teela has nice muscles, which is quite cool because unlike the old one, this one looks a lot cooler in it. It kind of had that nostalgic feel to it. So I think if you were a fan of the original and you have children, this is the sort of thing you can watch with them. And, you know, you have things like Evil Lyn saying things like He-Man was a glorified goody-goody. That kind of made me chuckle because they kind of made fun of the old and brought it into the new in many ways. I like the idea of the girl saying, look, I own my power. And that, again, is something that I keep saying to myself every day. So it felt good that they've brought all of that in together into this, and hearing him say, by the power of Grayskull, it kind of took me back to my childhood in Nigeria. And there's a good kind of cliffhanger for part two that's potentially coming in August. And there's a comic coming out to align with that also, apparently. So this is all quite exciting. If you were a fan, I think you might watch it and enjoy it. But it takes a while to get into it. That's what I'd say. So give yourself that time and patience. And if you don't have that time and patience, move on. Watch Never Have I Ever instead.
Layla, were you a fan originally, or was this something that you just had to watch for this week?
You know, I didn't really grow up watching He-Man and She-Ra. I think, I don't know why, I guess maybe my parents kind of didn't think it was quite right. So I had no real reference to this aside from the recent Netflix adaptation of She-Ra that came out like 3 years ago, maybe. And I watched that with my daughter and I thought that was awesome. And it was like this really kind of up-to-date feminist, a bit similar things. She's strong, she's got muscles, her love interest is a woman in the final season and stuff, and I really like that. And I think this didn't do as much for me because I think you need to have the nostalgia for it to come into it. Like, I felt a little bit watching it like it was a lot of inside jokes that I didn't get, if that makes sense. So I think probably one just for people that are already fans of He-Man.
Yeah, I agree. I watched He-Man as a kid, not particularly fond of it, so aware of it, but without having sort of real nostalgia for it. And I honestly found this kind of boring, in as much as if I watched old He-Man now, it just wouldn't be something I'd want to watch. So I think you really need, as you say, to have that absolute nostalgia for it and the appreciation of how old school they've gone. And obviously taking in the little elements that you said, Ashanti, but that it really is, for the most part, a replication of what you saw before. And for some people who, you know, miss that from their childhood, this is going to be wonderful. It clearly is for Kevin Smith. But for newcomers, I'm not sure there's enough going on there when we've got so used to more sophisticated fare.
Agreed.
So are we saying yay or nay to people watching this on Netflix when it drops on Friday?
I'm on the fence with this one. I think it's one for the parent to decide, but it's not one for the adults. It's one of those where, would you watch this with your kid? Did you love it before? Do you want an updated version? And do you want your child to feel that with you? If not, then give it a miss.
Or you're an adult trapped with a child inside them who never grew up. Sort of, there's plenty of them around as well.
Yes.
So if you were a major fan and you just want to get back to that, although maybe if you did, you just want to see the originals anyway. Maybe you have them on a creaky old VHS that you watch in the cellar. I don't know, but it is on Netflix. Okay, it's time for some vengeance now with this.
Jeg beder om at finde alt, hvad I kan for rockergruppen Riders of Justice. Det er Emmentaler, vores face recognition ekspert.
Den er så god til at finde ting. Er det noget, I kan, uden at lægge spores?
Jeg har fattet, det er det nemmeste for dig i
verden. Det er det nemmeste for mig i verden.
So this is Riders of Justice. Layla, tell us about this. Who's in it and who's out for justice?
It is my beloved Mads Mikkelsen as Marcus, who is a soldier in the army out in the Middle East. And whilst he's out there, there is a terrible tragedy, and his daughter and his wife are in a train accident where the daughter survives, but his wife is very sadly killed. In the aftermath of that, his daughter, Mathilde, who survived, is sort of getting more and more distant with her dad as he works through grief in his particular way and like really struggles to recover from this terrible incident that's happened to them. Meanwhile, there is a man called Otto who is working on an algorithm who's basically has this theory that there is no such thing as coincidence. It's just that we don't have enough data to understand the cause and effect of everything. And so if you get enough information, you can actually predict the future and figure out why any single thing happened. And maybe in the case of this accident, it all comes down to a bicycle being stolen that set off this terrible chain of events. It's very kind of Coen Brothers-esque in tone. Like, there's a real kind of like bumbling funny moments punctuated with like incredible violence and like that dark comedic side of things. I absolutely love this. It kind of worked for me absolutely brilliantly. I found the moving bits moving, the funny bits funny, and the kind of thrilling bits thrilling. Mads Mikkelsen, I mean, he's just like the most compelling screen presence. I have been very ride or die for him ever since Hannibal, and I don't think he's ever really put a foot wrong. Even in a film that isn't as strong as this one, he's always a really interesting stage presence. But I really like this, and particularly as a companion piece to Another Round. I mean, I love that Mads Mikkelsen still goes and makes films in Denmark and hasn't just kind of gone off to Hollywood entirely. But like, it's just kind of middle-aged men doing stupid stuff in a way that I found really sweet about, like, oh, these kinds of these things kind of have like quite nice thematic ideas similarly about, you know, what it is to go through a midlife crisis. So yeah, I really, really like this one.
Yeah. Did you like it, Ashanti?
I absolutely loved it. I had really liked Another Round, and this one, weirdly, in the Danish box office, they had a cinematic release for this and it had beaten Another Round. So they got, you know, a double treat of the man himself. I lived in Denmark as a small child, so I suddenly felt like just hearing them speak in Danish also felt really good for me. And it just had so much to it. I mean, I'm the daughter of a mathematician, and I was unfortunately very bad at statistics. So he's a pure mathematician, my dad, and I had to do statistics at university. And this guy talking about statistics at the beginning, it just got me all very interested, because I know what you can do. And I'd worked in the corporate world about what you can do with data and turning that into information. But is it going to be good information, and will it be bad? And that's what they get to the crux of in this film. And I love the way they did it. It's a story filled with passion and lots of fantastic characters. And, you know, there's the super geek guy, you know, he's like given pizza and he helps them. There's like a lot of powerful sound design, and I love the way they use the music to build the tension. Lots of shocking bits, you know, like, without even saying this as a spoiler, there's a head snap that just made me go, you know, and all that kind of, you feel the repressed anger of this Emmenthaler character, who otherwise comes across as this little geek who's sitting in a basement, but actually then you see another side of him. And there was so much to it, you know, the PTSD of the army father in this, and that was captured really well. The sweetheart of a rent boy, this boy who'd had such a horrible life, but actually when he meets these people, and this is like a set of misfits that all come together, and he meets them and they become this wonderful family. And all of this teamed with the butterfly effect, you can't go wrong with it if you do it right. And they did it right with this one.
Yeah, I mean, this could go very wrong. I mean, tonally, you talked about this, Layla, it tonally shifts and flip-flops throughout from really horrible violence as the group sort of seek retribution for something that they feel needs doing that the police will not do anything about. And it sort of toys with sort of big themes of the grey areas of culpability and blame, grief, chance and coincidence, survivor guilt. There's so much going on here, and that could all be too much and tonally just go completely off the rails. But the delicacy, I think, here of the direction, and as you say, Mikkelsen sort of leading this sort of troupe of sort of Shakespearean characters through this very complex, different twists and turns, really, really works. And I know you love him, Layla, and he is just fantastic in this. The guy doesn't even have to say anything for you to understand the pain that's going on in him, or the rage or the compassion or whatever it is. He's an amazing, amazing actor. And then you put him in the situation with two people who are sort of clowning next to him as well. It just makes it so bittersweet and sad, and also funny and darkly funny. I was watching this and I tweeted about it, and I think you texted me and said, is the film you're watching in your top 10? Is what is it? And I was like, it's this. Because even whilst I was watching it, I was like, I'm watching Gold. I love this. I love it even more. And every minute that went past, I was just like, and I love this and I love that. I mean, if I was to say, have a criticism, I'd probably say that you could totally pick holes in it in terms of plot. I mean, real world doesn't really come into this. The police don't even factor in this fact that they're sort of on a killing spree. If this was reality, I mean, their DNA would be all over everything and this would have a very different ending. So you have to view it as a fable, don't you? And something heightened. So if you're not into that, then that might be annoying for you. But if you're able to go on the ride, I think it's just an amazing piece of work.
Yeah, I found it, all of the stuff about grief really moving, and like this idea about like when terrible things happen, you want to make sense of it. You want everything to have a reason why it's happened in order for you to process it. But even if that reason comes, that doesn't make the terrible thing that happens to you any better.
That scene in the bathroom, no spoilers, but there's a particular scene in the bathroom that happened that is just devastating emotionally. There's a huge sort of explosive rage, and then something that happens after that was so affecting, wasn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely. And I felt like I was completely immersed in this film, and that doesn't happen to me very often these days. That immersive experience that they created with it, and like Jane rightly said, it's more like a fable because, you know, this is completely fictional, but it takes you into that world for a few hours, and it again, just like old, this one makes you think, and I like that about films.
Absolutely. Okay, so I think we can say we highly recommend Riders of Justice, out today on Friday. I think we might know what our film of the week is when we get to the end, but let's continue.
Two-way draw for me.
Okay. Before we go on to our final film, let's just demystify a bit of chat that happens in the film world with Plain Talking, which is our regular feature where we explain what words and weird phrases are from the film industry. And the one we're going to talk about this week is junket, going on a junket. Ladies, what is going on a junket? What does it mean if you're going on a junket?
So I came into the world of writing and broadcasting, having been in a completely different world, in corporate worlds, going into server rooms, you know. So for me, the first time I got this invite saying, come to a junket, I literally had to Google it, checked in with somebody who went to Goldsmiths. What does this mean? What is this? And it turns out that you just get to go and have an interview with somebody who's in a film, for example, or a TV show. I'm not quite sure how this word came about. It was a strange one, but it's always a nice one when it's nice people we're interviewing. So going on a junket with Dev Patel is always fun.
Yes. It's one of these things where they're basically sausage meeting the talent, aren't they, through a series of interviews. And it's generally at a posh hotel. You sit in a room and you're taken to another room where somebody's sitting doing numerous interviews. And so that process where they're doing all the TV interviews, the radio interviews, the print interviews, the entire process is the junket. Been on any good ones, Layla?
I've only ever done one in person, but I've been doing a lot of virtual junkets at the moment, which is sort of very strange because they kind of want to recreate the hotel junket thing, and that you have like waiting rooms and like stuff. And I'm just like, you could just tell me to show up at a time. I'm punctual. All of the film journalists sit in their like little Zoom rooms together, and then one person goes off at a time. But I end up feeling quite sorry for the actor. You know, I've tried with my questions, but you will be answering the same thing a lot today. And kind of, I can imagine that just driving me slightly mad. If I had the choice, I'd always like to just kind of interview someone in a 20 minutes they had spare rather than in a junket after a big queue of people.
Yes, indeed. Agreed. Indeed. Agreed. But if you go to a junket, you do get fed. And as everyone knows, if they listen to this, I'm very interested in any free food I can get. So I do enjoy getting a nice cookie from a posh hotel and a cup of tea and a china teacup and saucer.
Yes.
Very, very nice. Anyway, that is a junket. Shall we go on to our final film of the week then? It's time to slow everything down with this.
Tuesday, January 1st, 1856. With little pride and less hope, we begin the new year.
Who is that?
Good afternoon.
I'm Tally.
Abigail.
I hope I'm not keeping you from something.
I'm glad you've come. The meeting you has made my day.
Well, how pleasant and uncommon it is to make someone's day.
So this is the world to come. This has been a long time coming. It was at various festivals and has been slated for release numerous times. It's apparently coming out now. Ashanti, what's it about?
So this one literally takes you way back. And as Jane said, you have to slow down to watch this. Your mind has to be in the right space because we're going back in time to 1856, you know, and this is an age of isolation that we're shown, and kind of at the back of a pandemic where lots of us have been isolated at home, this might be the right time for this film to come out. It's got Catherine Waterson, Vanessa Kirby, Christopher Abbott, and Casey Affleck. And whilst I was watching it, I had lots of other films I've seen over time that I thought, oh, this reminds me of Ammonite, this reminds me of Portrait of a Woman on Fire, this reminds me of Fire by Deepa Mehta. So there were lots of films that it kind of reminds you of. And it's basically a story of these two women who live in isolation with their husbands. They befriend each other and they fall in love. And this kind of story we've seen so many times with a male-female relationship. Very rarely do we see it in an LGBTQIA spectrum type situation. And that's something I really thought was a plus point for this. And it's just the way this film has been made that I was totally immersed into it. I was pulled into that world. And I didn't expect to be, honestly. I started watching it. And normally in those first 5 minutes, I have to think, oh, am I going to like this film? Am I going to be able to sit through it all? It's a very long film. But this actually then pulled me in because Catherine Waterson, she is such a fantastic actress, and her face and her eyes and all those movements that she's doing just do so much talking for us. It just took me in. There's also this bonding between these two women because they're childless and I have no children. I can't have children. So for me, that was something that kind of pulled me in as well. And shout outs in this one to the DOP, Andre Chemetov, because he's gazing lovingly at Vanessa Kirby, who is such a beautiful woman. You know, I've seen some of his other work. He did MIA's kind of politically loaded Born Free video. And that was like a huge statement video. So seeing the kind of range this guy has, because then he's taken a film like this, The World to Come, and wow, you know, wow is what I can say. And there are lines in this film like, you smell like a biscuit. I mean, only a woman will say that to another woman. Although I said it once to a man because he smelled like cardamom. But this is really sweet. I was like, you smell like cardamom. But this one, in this case, you know, there are lines like that that are really beautiful. And there are lots of powerful words that they're woven into it. It's quite sparse in terms of people's dialogue to each other. But when they do talk, it's very meaningful, which I really loved about this film as well. And there's a line here, you are my city of joy. And that completely stole my heart. So this one is a big yay from me.
Layla, were you swept away with the sort of poetic nature of this?
God, I feel so bad after hearing Ashanti say how much she loved it. It didn't do anywhere near as much for me. And I do think that part of that for me, I am being unfair because I love Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I really, really loved Ammonite. And I think this is just the weakest of the three. We don't have to, I suppose, make all of these films compete with one another. But when you see things that have got like thematic kind of Victorian women falling in love with each other, you kind of can't help but rank them. Yeah, I do entirely agree about Vanessa Kirby, though. I think she is just radiant. She's such a screen presence. But this seems to keep happening with films of hers for me, where I love her in them, but I don't like the film itself that much. Like, so yeah, I kind of love her talent and don't like her taste in projects. I would say I did really also like Casey Affleck in it. I saw someone describe him online as the king of internalized anguish, and I think that's really accurate. But I mean, not to be entirely in the gutter, but I thought that was one of the worst sex scenes I've ever seen in this film, and it really just left a kind of terrible note. And kind of not since Queen and Slim have I been so offended by the way a sex scene has been edited. So I didn't hate it. I'd suggest watching Ammonite instead. But I feel terrible saying that, especially given that it meant so much to you, Ashanti. But it somehow just didn't connect with me.
I would put it above Ammonite. I liked it a lot better than Ammonite. So I found it a lot more passionate than Ammonite, and the sort of warming up of Catherine Waterston's character much more sort of believable than the Winslet one in Ammonite. I found she was just too gruff all the way through it, and one note for me. Then obviously she came along with Mayor of Easttown and All Was Forgiven. The thing I really liked about this is it felt a bit like that. We looked at First Cow the other week. It felt a bit like that slow cinema, which I think maybe I've just got into that a lot more with the fact that we're having slow lives at the moment before we get back into the rush of modern life. Nothing moves fast in it. People come over and talk about the cow or the snow. You know, they say your flowers look pretty in their vase, whatever. There's so nothing happens. But then I loved this sort of torrid voiceover that happened. And voiceovers are not something I love generally.
No.
I just felt it was so beautifully written. And I loved to hear them say these things about the letters they'd written to each other. For me, it was like a sort of actual physical manifestation of reading a book. And I really enjoyed that, probably because I haven't read a book for like 2 years, because I have no sense of concentration for a book at all anymore. I don't know what that is. I think that's a COVID situation too. But it felt like it was reading a book in film version for me. And I love that.
I can't help but feel that those two actresses just didn't have the chemistry. I'm surprised that I'm a lone voice here. I thought we were all going to be a little less keen.
I actually did love their chemistry. Somehow for me, that it really worked for me. And also there were lots of ideas here about grief and isolation and mental health, you know, keeping your mind occupied. Her buying an atlas, for example, that, you know, that idea of her wanting to escape, the female companionship. And, you know, when she kind of says, you know, his mind is in such a bad place, it affects his whole system. And seeing these men who are trying, but they're actually quite toxic to these women in many ways, that you don't naturally think of that. But in those days, you know, these women don't have much of an option to walk away from these men. And I think there was a lot I could relate to, perhaps maybe from things I've experienced in my own life. And maybe I was just connecting with so many different themes in it.
Well, I couldn't relate to them really that much, but I could relate to that longing for somebody and the sort of idea that, you know, in this world that men rule and women are punished for whatever it is that they have deemed to do wrong, whether that's not producing a child at the right time or producing a child and losing a child. Women are punished in this Victorian world, and the frontier is hard for everybody. We do see the harshness of this, don't we? You're in these houses with no heating, obviously, in these terrible winters with not very much to eat. It's a hard, hard life. And then you add to that the female experience. And within this horrible sort of harsh life, this love blossoms, which is beautiful and pure and nourishing and lovely and warm. Yes. And so I liked that idea of a rose on thorny ground. But that's just me, I think, being a bit soppy now, because
Layla's making me rethink. I'll watch it again.
Watch it again, Layla. Watch it again and have a rethink. Because
I'm sorry, you will not get me to agree to that sex scene, though. That was horrendous.
Okay, so sex scene aside, two of us are saying this is a little treat, this is a bit of loveliness. One of us is going to watch it again and we'll see the teacher. Okay, so that is The World to Come in cinemas on Friday. That's all we've got time for. So what's our film of the week, do we think?
Riders.
Yeah, Riders for me.
For me, it is a tie between Riders and Old, because I really appreciate, with both of these films, seeing something unconventional, like really realized with a particular vision. And like, I think both of them pull it off.
Very, very different. So those are two very different films to see this weekend. Okay, before we go, time for a reader's question. What film do you hate that everybody else loves? Ashanti.
Oh, don't hate me, readers, but it's the Alien films for me.
Uh-oh.
Jane's not going to want to dine with me now after hearing this, and Layla might cancel her dinner date with me next week. So I'll tell you why. I love Sigourney Weaver and I love the idea of this story. I found it so compelling, but I could not stand the disgusting monster on screen. And I just could not watch it. I remember as a child, they were selling, you know, at Argos, you used to sell the alien, you know, and you could buy it. And yes, So because of that, I just couldn't watch the films and I just didn't watch them. And unfortunately, because of that, I dislike them.
It's a mucus problem, I think.
I am at the opposite end of the spectrum. I've actually been to the H.R. Geiger Museum to go and see more of the alien design.
Yeah. And I've been more than she once. Loves the mucus.
I can get more mucus. Yeah, that was my only note.
More mucus at the museum. Layla, what do you hate that everybody else loves?
Oh, yeah. So, I call them Emperor's New Clothes films, where everybody loves it and you just feel like you're insane Yes. She's just like, no, this is trash. I hate with a fiery passion the film Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. I hate everything about it. I think Frances McDormand's performance is embarrassingly one note. I think Sam Rockwell is actually playing something that's not even recognizable as a human. I think the film just picks up ideas, doesn't examine them or look at them with any interesting way. And I think it's got a rubbish ending. I hate that film.
Okay,
that does seem to be very unpopular, though. I have to say, this is not something I've admitted publicly before.
Okay.
For fear that I'll be banned from film Twitter.
Yes, awards bodies would disagree, but okay. I hate the Lord of the Rings series.
All of them?
I cannot stick a little Merry Pippin-y, hobbity, big-footed, twee, tiny houses drinking beer, looking for things with my friend. I can't. No. Absolutely. I just can't bear it. It's not for me. I don't know what it is. I still can't really put my finger on it, but I want to hit the hobbits. I can't.
So you're rooting for the big eye in the sky.
I'm totally into that. Just blast them all, get rid of them and the silly little houses. I don't care about romances. I don't even like old, you know, Vigo turning up with his sword. None of it does it for me at all. I just don't get it on any level. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because I've got a piece of coal for a heart. I don't know.
I can resonate with you on that one because I think for me it was Gollum. I really detested Gollum. And because of that, again, like that alien, I just did not like these films like I should have.
So let us know on Twitter how wrong we are.
Just gotten us all cancelled. Thanks, Jane.
don't at me, people.
Yeah, we're not saying at me, but do let Total Film know on Twitter films you hate that everybody else loves. My other one's The Master. Don't get it. Anyway.
My other one's Joker.
So now we're fighting. So let's take this offline to discuss all the ways you're wrong. And for now, we'll say goodbye.
Bye.
Cheerio.
Bye.
Riders on the storm, riders on the storm, into this house we're born. Like a dog without a bone.